Well, like the, yeah, like the convention, CFD, mental force.
Got it. Okay.
Why do 20 people do that?
Right.
No, the cardiologist, if that's even there, works on here. Go, thanks. Great.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Monroe Carmen. I'm president of the club and editor-at-large at Bloomberg Business News. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience, as well as those of you watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of coming speakers. On Thursday, November 16th, choreographer Jacques D'Ambois, founder of the National Dance Institute, will be with us. On Tuesday, November 21st, Grammy Award-winning trumpeter Wynton Marsalis will talk about his role as artistic director of jazz at Lincoln Center Program in New York and teaching young people about jazz music. Then on Tuesday, November 28th, Bill Gates, chairman and CEO of Microsoft, will speak to our audience here. Transcripts and audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available by calling 1-800-NPC-2334. The National Press Club is also pleased to announce the publication of a new book, The National Press Club's Best Contemporary Speakers. The book contains 13 of the best speeches made during the year of 1994. To order a copy, just call the same number, 1-800-NPC-2334. And if our guests in the audience have any questions for our speaker, you'll find some cards at your table. Please write your questions down, pass them up, and I will ask as many as time permits. And now I'd like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Steve Hurst of CNN. Abdul Salam Masarway. Good? Thank you. Arab American Media Service. Carol Giacomo, Reuters News Service. Du Powell, Hearst Newspapers. Barbara Starr, Washington Bureau Chief for Jane's Defense Weekly. Victoria Nuland, Executive Assistant to the Deputy Secretary of State. Skipping over our speaker for a moment, Mark Johnson, Media General News Service and Chairman of the National Press Club's Speakers Committee. Justin Leitis, Staff Officer of the to the Deputy Secretary of State, I'm sorry. Peggy Roberson, freelance journalist and member of the National Press Club Committee, who arranged today's luncheon. Thank you, Peggy. Stan Kroc of Businessweek. Barry Schweid of the Associated Press. And we may have another. Tom Rhodes of the London Times said he'd be here maybe in a few minutes. Our speaker today is Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbott, one of journalism's best and brightest. He was nominated to his present position by President Clinton on February 22, 1994, and was sworn into office by Secretary of State Warren Christopher the following day. Before becoming a diplomat, Mr. Talbott was Time Magazine's editor-at-large from 1989 until 1993. Earlier, he was Time's Washington Bureau Chief for 5 years. His first overseas assignment for Time from 1971 through 1973 was as its Eastern European correspondent based in Belgrade. He served the magazine as diplomatic correspondent from 1977 to 1984, White House correspondent during the Ford administration, and State Department correspondent when Henry Kissinger was Secretary of State, 1974 through 1975. Deputy Secretary Talbot is a scholar as well as a reporter, editor, and diplomat. He translated and edited two volumes of Nikita Khrushchev's memoirs published in 1970 and 1974. His expertise in arms control and Soviet affairs has been displayed in numerous articles and books, including Endgame, The Inside Story of SALT II, published in 1979, Deadly Gambits, published in 1984, and Master of the Game, Bull Nitti and the Nuclear Peace, published in 1985. His latest book, published in 1993, co-authored with Michael Beschloss, is, quote, At the Highest Levels, The Inside Story of the End of the Cold War. Deputy Secretary Talbot has twice won the Edward Weintraub Prize for Distinguished Reporting on Foreign Affairs and Diplomacy in 1980 and 85. His contributions were also cited in three Overseas Press Club Awards to Time in 1982, 1987, and 1989. Born in Dayton, Ohio, he was educated at the Hotchkiss School and Yale University, graduating in 1968. Following graduation, he spent 3 years at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. It was there that he met and became a friend and a roommate of a young scholar from Arkansas, Bill Clinton. Deputy Secretary Talbot is married to Brooke Shearer. They have two children. Please welcome to the National Press Club, Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot, who will speak to us on U.S. leadership and the Balkan challenge. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bud, very much. And thanks to all of you for the chance to be here today. I've been to quite a few events here at the Press Club over the years, and I'm very glad to have an opportunity to return for the first time in my official capacity. I do so to discuss with you, for whatever time we have, the American effort to bring peace to the former Yugoslavia. Let me, if I may, begin with an update on the talks in Dayton. I went out to Dayton on Monday to meet with Dick Holbrooke and his team, with Carl Bildt, the European Union representative, and the contact group envoys who were out there, and also with the leaders of the parties to the conflict. Most of the draft documents that comprise the overall peace settlement that we are hoping will emerge from the Dayton talks are now in the hands of the parties. Those include detailed constitutional and territorial proposals for a future Bosnian state, a separation of forces agreement, plan for national elections, and an agreement on the return of refugees. There are every day numerous intensive meetings and different combinations and settings on virtually every aspect of the prospective settlement. President Tudjman of Croatia returned to Dayton last night. We hope to use his presence to make some progress on the immensely difficult and important issue of Eastern Slavonia. Secretary Christopher will be going to Dayton tomorrow to provide further high-level support for the process. And that's it. The lid on Dayton is now back on until this time tomorrow, when you can all tune in to Nick Burns for a glimpse into what we're trying, for what I think are solid diplomatic reasons, to preserve as a very tightly held, closed process. What I would like to do now is step back for a few moments and look at the larger question of what is at stake in Dayton. And that means having a clear sense of the consequences for our country and for the world if the talks in Dayton were to fail and the Balkans were to be plunged back into war. Then I would like to look ahead to the challenge that we will face if the talks in Dayton succeed. Many of you here in this room have pointed out in your own commentary and your own writings that the administration has a very tough job of persuasion ahead of it, here on the home front generally, and that means not just up on Capitol Hill, but also beyond the Beltway and around the country. We know that. We understand that it is not self-evident to the American people why a conflict nearly 5,000 miles from here matters enough to justify a heavy investment of our treasure, our prestige, and our military resources. So let me start with that question. Why does it matter? Bosnia matters to Americans because Europe matters to America. War in Bosnia threatens the peace of Europe, particularly, though not by any means exclusively, those parts of Europe that are emerging from Soviet-era dictatorships. And that means it threatens the transatlantic community of which we are a part and of which we are a leader. The conflict in the Balkans is a direct consequence of the end of the Cold War. During that nearly half-century-long struggle, we were concerned about the spread of communist order. Now that the Cold War is over, we face a very different threat, the spread of post-communist disorder. That danger exists in part because of where the former Yugoslavia is, which is to say it is on a fault line between East and West, between Europe and Asia. If warfare breaks out anew and continues unabated, it could very well suck in other nations to the north, the south, and the east. Albania, for example, could intervene to protect the ethnic Albanians who live in the southern Serbian province of Kosovo. Fighting there could cause a massive flow of refugees into Macedonia, which would destabilize that fragile, newly independent country and perhaps draw in on opposite sides our two NATO allies, Greece and Turkey. A widening of the war might also tempt Hungary to come to the rescue of ethnic Hungarians in the Vojvodina region of northern Serbia. Meanwhile, the entire Islamic world is watching. Muslims everywhere are waiting to see whether their co-religionists in Bosnia will be accorded the same rights and protections as other Europeans. And the answer to that question could have an impact on the future of moderate pro-Western leaders such as Prime Minister Chiller of Turkey and Prime Minister Bhutto of Pakistan. And at the same time, other forces in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf see the Balkans as a target of opportunity. Iran's repeated offer to send peacekeepers, so-called, to Bosnia is hardly motivated by altruism. And then there is the fate of NATO, which is also very much tied up in what happens in the former Yugoslavia. A continuation of the war would threaten, we believe, the viability of an organization that is absolutely vital to the United States and absolutely vital to Europe. If we were to adopt, as some in effect are counseling, a posture of standing aside with our fingers crossed behind our backs, we would end up harming our bilateral relations with Britain, France, and other allies that have troops on the ground in Bosnia. And we would also be discrediting both the alliance and our role in the alliance. Another point. If the fighting in Yugoslavia were to resume, and if it escalates and spreads, it would put increasing strain on relations between the United States and the Russian Federation. And it would do so at a time of ferment and uncertainty in Russian domestic politics. In short, a new eruption of fighting in the Balkans would undermine our main twin strategic objectives in Europe. Those are, first, to advance integration between East and West, and second, to restrain and, if possible, stop post-communist disintegration in the East. So those are the stakes. The high stakes justify, indeed, require bold action. And that means we must be hard-headed in assessing the costs and the risks that come with bold action. But we must be just as tough-minded in recognizing the costs and risks that we will incur if we choose inaction, particularly inaction or inadequate action in the face of atrocities like mass rape, concentration camps, massacres, and forced deportations. As recently as August, Bosnian Serb authorities in Banja Luka made local Muslims wear special white armbands and marked their homes with white cloth as a prelude to ethnic cleansing. That administrative euphemism, coupled with the deja vu of armbands, makes clear what we have been up against in Bosnia. In third, and it is the right word. It's genocide in our time, genocide on the continent of Europe. Now, at issue here is not just an outrage against humanity, but a challenge to American interests and to American leadership. Faraway peoples look to us and count on us, not just because of our economic strength and our military power, but also because of what we stand for and what we are prepared to stand up against and to act against. Taking decisive action in the Balkans has been especially difficult. There were, for a long time, severe limits on what the international community could do to make peace until the parties themselves were prepared to make peace. But there is no question what is required today, and it's a combination of diplomatic skill and the credible threat of force to keep the parties at the negotiating table. And that means keeping them from returning to the battlefield, not to mention the killing fields. It also means putting an end to genocide and bringing to justice perpetrators of crimes against humanity. That is why we fully support the work of Judge Richard Goldstone and the United Nations War Crimes Tribunal. We have dispatched 23 officials of our government to work as prosecutors and researchers for the tribunal, and we are fighting on Capitol Hill to preserve the funding that is necessary for the tribunal to keep up its important work. We are also making an energetic, systematic effort to provide the war crimes investigators and prosecutors with the facts that they need to do their work. Even when relevant information comes from intelligence or other classified sources, we will find a way to get it to Judge Goldstone in a timely and useful manner. John Shattuck, our Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, is now traveling across Bosnia. This is his fourth trip there in 2 months. His mission is to mobilize the full resources of the United States government in the investigation of atrocities and to gather additional material that will prove useful to the tribunal. Let me add that all of us recognize the crucial and sometimes heroic role that the press has played in informing the world about the horror in the Balkans. You, like we, have lost colleagues. Even with a ceasefire in place, covering that story remains dangerous, as we were all reminded by the ordeal of David Rode. In talking to Mr. Rode yesterday, President Clinton and Secretary Christopher made it clear we intend to hold Serb officials to their commitments that Western journalists as well as Western diplomats will have access to the suspected sites of human rights violations. The War Crimes Tribunal has already issued 46 indictments, including 3 more this morning, and Judge Goldstone, who will be in Washington next week, has told us to expect dozens more indictments in the fairly near future. We have made it clear that no indicted war criminals will be involved in negotiations, in the signing of agreements, or in subsequent elections according to the procedures that are being worked out in Dayton. In other words, the peace process will not impede the investigation of atrocities or the prosecution of those responsible. Indicted war criminals like Dr. Karadzic and General Mladic should recognize that amnesties and immunities are simply not on the table in Dayton or anywhere else. We or any other responsible members of the international community apprehend them, they will get a quick one-way trip to a courtroom in The Hague. Let me say a few more words, if I could, about ethnic cleansing in the Balkans and why that phenomenon, by that or any other name, is not only an issue of Moralpolitik, it is also an issue of Realpolitik. Even when the phrase ethnic cleansing means merely mass deportation rather than mass murder, it captures the very essence of what is most insidious and what is most contagious about the catastrophe that has befallen the former Yugoslavia. Too many leaders of those republics turned independent states have tried to define statehood, citizenship, and international borders in terms of ethnic homogeneity and ethnic purity. And they feel that the logic of this attitude somehow gives them the right to engage in the purification, the ethnic cleansing of their states. Hence, the dream of Greater Serbia, which is a nightmare for all non-Serbs, whether they live in Serbia proper or amid ethnic Serbs in neighboring states. Equally unacceptable is the idea of an ethnically pure Croatia that would deny the legitimate rights of Croatian Muslims and Serbs. We have given President Tudjman a clear, unambiguous message, and we've given it to him in Dayton as well as in Zagreb. If Croatia wants the benefits of membership in the community of market democracies, but wants to enjoy the international respectability to which it feels entitled, then it will have to ensure that the non-Croats in its population have the full rights and protections of citizenship. Our support for Croatia is contingent, explicitly contingent, on Croatia's continuing support for the Bosnian Federation. Moreover, we will, along with our allies, do everything that we can to discourage the irredentist fantasies of any leader in the Balkans. I stress this point because if aggressive nationalism were to triumph in the former Yugoslavia, it will not only be devastating in that region, it will be ominous elsewhere as well, especially to the north and to the east. Throughout the former Soviet Empire, dark forces, similar to those that have convulsed the Balkans, are vying with the forces of freedom and tolerance to fill the partial vacuum that has been left by the collapse of communist systems. Just to cite one example, the lethal syndrome that we often call Balkanization could just as well be termed Caucasization, which is to say that the people of Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia have suffered in much the same way and for some of the same reasons as the people of the Balkans. Indeed, it's interesting and I think germane that the very term ethnic cleansing originated in the context of the Caucasus and not in the context of the Balkans. If there is to be a post-Cold War peace in Europe, and that means not a cold peace, but a real one, it must be based on the principle of multi-ethnic democracy. The United States is one of the first and one of the greatest examples of that principle. What's more, civic behavior and the constitutional structures that are associated with political pluralism are also conducive to regional peace and international trade. Hence, it is in our interest as Americans that multi-ethnic democracy ultimately prevails in Europe and elsewhere. Now, I know the question hangs in the air, can those values and institutions ever take hold in the former Yugoslavia? I realize there's a lot of skepticism, if not cynicism, on that point. Many people in the debate have asserted, or at least implied, the conflict going on among Serbs and Croats and Muslims is quite simply insoluble, that the region is a permanent and hopeless quagmire, which is a word intended to have in our ears cautionary echoes of Vietnam. Listen carefully, and you sometimes will hear in the current debate a hint that there's something in the air or the water of the Balkans that dooms those wretched people to slaughter each other. That's often, I think, the subliminal message in the cliche about ancient hatreds. Now, if you'll permit me a personal comment here, having lived in Yugoslavia for 2 years of my career as a journalist, and having seen how the South Slavs could live harmoniously with each other, I find this view that I just represented to be wrongheaded in the extreme. There was nothing predestined about the horror that has been raging in the Balkans for the past 4 years. It was foolish, demagogic, local politics, along with short-sighted international diplomacy that helped trigger, in the late 1980s and early 1990s, the Third Balkan War of this century. By that same token, it will take sound, far-sighted diplomacy, including plenty of American statesmanship and leadership, to head off a resumption and an escalation of that war now. That task will be plenty hard enough without encumbering ourselves with the excess baggage of historical, not to mention ethnic, determinism. Let's remember, as we put our shoulder to the wheel in the Balkans, that patience and persistence have paid off in other areas that were long believed to be in the too hard category, the Middle East, Northern Ireland, and South Africa. There's hope for the former Yugoslavia as well. Now, why is that hope realistic today when it seemed so forlorn only a short time ago? President Clinton has pressed for the vigorous use of NATO air power as a necessary component of peacemaking since the early days of his presidency. But it took 2.5 years for the pieces of the puzzle to come together in a way that would permit that strategy to work. The murderous Serb capture of Srebrenica in early July was unquestionably a key turning point. It moved the international community to take a quantum leap in what it was willing to do, protect the UN-designated safe areas, and to punish continuing Serb aggression. At Secretary Christopher's urging, the London conference in late July streamlined the mechanism for backing diplomacy with force. No more cumbersome dual key arrangements, no more pinprick airstrikes. Seizing the moment, President Clinton undertook a new diplomatic initiative. Secretary Christopher, Tony Lake, Dick Holbrook worked the diplomatic front. Meanwhile, U.S. and NATO warplanes, no longer grounded by the dual key, reinforced, much more convincingly than they had done before, the message that the time had come to stop the killing and start talking about the terms of a political settlement. Since then, our negotiating team has made real progress. Parties have accepted the continuation of Bosnia-Herzegovina as a single, multi-ethnic state within its current internationally recognized borders. Within that state, the parties have agreed that there will be two constituent entities. Now, that arrangement, we believe, will make it possible for fratricidal passions to cool down. People of Bosnia quite simply need time to recover from the disintegration that they have been through, and they need time to rediscover first the possibility and then the advantages of genuine integration. If, and it is still a very big if, the Dayton talks succeed and the three heads of state there agree on a peace settlement, then the tough work of implementation will begin. And there, too, the United States must take the lead. And that means we must be willing to send troops. Let me, if I could, walk you through the logic why that is true. After 4 years of brutal war, there is, to put it mildly, little trust left among the different communities in Bosnia. Peace will require an armed international presence to give the parties the confidence that they need to carry out the settlement and to begin the long, hard work of rebuilding and living together again. Only one organization can enforce a peace, and that's NATO. Both the parties to the conflict and our NATO allies have made clear that they are counting on significant U.S. participation in the implementation force. Without our being there, the force as a whole won't be there, in which case there will quite simply be no peace, and we will face the array of consequences that I outlined a moment ago. Let me stress, as President Clinton did again yesterday in meeting with congressional leaders, two points. First, the implementation force will be deployed only if the parties agree to a real peace. And second, the force will be militarily formidable. It will be capable not only of defending itself, but also of compelling the parties to the peace agreement to live up to the commitments embodied in that settlement. We believe that 12 months is a reasonable period of time for the implementation force to accomplish its mission. While this will be a NATO-led operation, other nations, not members of the alliance, will also participate. So far, more than a dozen states, including Poland, Hungary, the Czech and Slovak Republics, Ukraine, and Pakistan, have expressed an interest in contributing, and so has Russia. Yesterday, Bill Perry and Pavel Grachov, his Russian counterpart, met in Brussels to hammer out the details of a joint operation. It will represent the most concrete example of U.S.-Russian military cooperation in the post-Cold War era. It's welcome in its own right and also as a precedent for the future, a future in which we hope that Russia and the United States, and for that matter, Russia and NATO, will find numerous ways to work together in building an undivided Europe. Let me conclude, if I may, by expanding on that last point, possible precedents for the future. The conflict in the former Yugoslavia has, none of us would dispute, gone on for far too long, been the cause of far, far too much carnage, too much misery, too much frustration, too much tension between us and our partners, both old and new. All of us wish that something like the Dayton talks could have taken place a year ago, better yet 2 years ago, better still 3 or 4 years ago. But we are where we are, and we must make the best of what we have before us today. And what we have today is an opportunity, far from certain, and still fraught with danger, but nonetheless very real, to turn Bosnia from a synonym for past failures and an evil portent for the future into something positive. Bosnia could yet turn out to be a demonstration, however belated, of international resolve to meet the first major challenge to the collective security of post-Cold War Europe. Taking advantage of this opportunity and passing this test, will require steadfastness in our diplomatic efforts and in our military commitment. But success will also require public and congressional support. And to muster and sustain that support, we'd better have the best possible answers to the toughest possible questions, starting with yours right now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. And now the questions. Does Secretary Christopher's trip to Dayton mean that a Bosnian agreement will be announced tomorrow or this weekend?
No. No, the Secretary, as I said, is going out to do what many of us are trying to do in occasional visits out there, and that is to provide an impulse to progress on various issues. There will certainly be quite a bit of discussion of the constitutional structures for the state of Bosnia-Herzegovina. I suspect because President Tudjman is now back at the table, back at several of the tables in Dayton, that there will also be discussion of Eastern Slavonia. We would hope that there might be progress on some issues, but I certainly do not think, do not expect that a comprehensive breakthrough is at hand. This is, I've talked to Dick Holbrooke already a couple of times this morning, and I can assure you that there is a lot of hard work still to be done.
If Congress fails to appropriate money for the sending of troops to Bosnia, will the administration use the added $7 billion in the Department of Defense Appropriations Bill to fund the operation?
I think it is absolutely paramount that the administration prevail in the dialogue that it is having with the legislative branch on this subject. There is no substitute for the kind of congressional and executive cooperation that is necessary in order to commit American troops to what will be a peace situation, but nonetheless a risky situation. We feel in the administration, President Clinton certainly feels, and Secretary Christopher, that we have the right arguments. We feel that we're making progress in an intense dialogue with the Congress. This is why the President met with members of Congress yesterday. So we hope that the issue of failing in this debate will not arise at the end of the day.
Surely you don't argue that American troops be placed in danger to prevent ethnic cleansing and other atrocities. Following that argument, wouldn't we send troops to places like Rwanda and to Georgia like we did when we mistakenly sent troops to Somalia?
The United States contributed substantially to the efforts both in Rwanda and also the efforts in Somalia. There are a great many people, tens of thousands at least, who are alive today in the Horn of Africa because of American humanitarian efforts, which in turn were made possible by the generosity of the American people, the engagement of American diplomacy, and also the airlift and logistical help of the U.S. military. Where Somalia went wrong was when it crossed a line into the area of nation building in an attempt to impose a political settlement on warring parties who didn't want to have a political settlement. That is fundamentally different from the challenge ahead of us in Bosnia if we get a settlement there. We are talking about putting Americans in as part of a peace that will have already been agreed to by the parties. Now, that is not to say for a moment that the situation will be without risk and will be without danger. But I can assure you, having worked closely with our colleagues in the Department of Defense who are planning the implementation for us, that even while hoping for the best, we are prepared for the worst in this situation as in any other. The force that is deployed will be more than capable of taking care of itself and implementing the agreement that we hope will come out of Dayton.
You have made it seem that if the ongoing peace talks fail, that all of Europe would be drawn into an endless Balkan war. But what's wrong with just letting the adversaries fight it out until the nations involved get tired of it? After all, Iran and Iraq called it quits after 8 years.
The Iran-Iraq war was very dangerous in its own right. I would contend that the war of the kind we have already seen and do not want to see again in southeastern Europe would be even more dangerous because of the considerations that I laid out in my remarks. I will not take up your time by repeating those arguments. Suffice it to say, we are absolutely convinced that this is a matter of sound, realistic analysis. This is not alarmism. This is not an effort to come up with the scariest arguments in order to justify American policy. It's American policy based on analysis of the danger. And the danger here is that if this war resumes, it very likely will spread because there is still a lot of explosive material around where the fire has now, for the time being, damped down. And that explosive material could blow up if the fire starts again. Let me just return to one example, if I could, that I mentioned in my remarks, and that is Kosovo. Having lived in Yugoslavia in the early 1970s, I remember from then what a dangerous situation Kosovo was, because there is a very large ethnic Albanian minority there that feels itself to be repressed in many ways by the Serbian authorities. So there is an Islamic dimension as well as a ethnic and political dimension to the problem. And I think that we can count it as good fortune that the Kosovo situation has not blown up before now, but we shouldn't press our luck. And simply standing by and waiting for the parties to exhaust themselves assumes that the conflict will implode inwards rather than exploding outwards. There is no assurance of that whatsoever. In fact, plenty of reasons to worry that an explosion is precisely what would happen. Spreading in several directions, including to these countries that have emerged from the old Warsaw Pact that we used to call Eastern European countries that are now fledgling democracies and trying to work out within their own borders and among themselves rules of civilized international conduct. We will not make it easier for them to do so if we let the fire in the Balkans rage unattended.
If U.S. Troops are placed in Bosnia following a peace accord, what criteria will Washington use to determine when they can be withdrawn?
An earlier question, quite pointed and quite appropriate, raised the bad experience that we had at the end of the day in Somalia. We have learned lessons as a country, not just as an administration, as a country, about peacekeeping and peacemaking from the bad experience that we had in Somalia. And one is, don't go in unless you know when and how you're going to get out. Have an exit strategy. I assure you that General Shalakashvili, Bill Perry, and their colleagues at the Pentagon, along with the rest of us in the administration, as we have put together an operational plan for a NATO-led implementation force, and this has involved, of course, the closest possible consultation with our NATO allies, we have kept very much in mind a couple of cardinal principles. And one is having an exit strategy, and I mentioned what that is. This is not just wishful thinking when we say that we estimate this to be a one-year operation. That is based on sound analysis and prognosis, taking into account the immensity of the political task that we'll have and the military task that will come with it. And, of course, another cardinal principle is that we have very robust rules of engagement, so-called, so that, to put it very bluntly, once this implementation force goes in, if anyone messes with it, they will be sorry. We have, in addition to the largely cautionary, if not negative, experience we've had in Somalia, I would also mention what has been net a positive experience that we have had in Haiti. And I just would ask all of you to recall what happened within a couple of days after the deployment of the multinational force in Haiti when some armed thugs associated with the old regime dared to draw their guns on a U.S. unit up in Cape Haitien. That precedent should be kept very much in mind by all of us and certainly the people that we will be dealing with in Bosnia if and when the implementation force goes in.
Will the Dayton peace talks come to a halt if the U.S. government comes to a halt next week?
No. So far, two no's on questions about Dayton. The Department of State, under Secretary Christopher's planning, has arrangements in place to cope with the shutdown if it occurs, to make sure that we can, as much as possible, continue the essential services and functions that we're carrying out. Now, that does not mean that there won't be an impact on your State Department's ability to serve Americans who are traveling abroad, advance American business interests, and also keep going our principal policy interests. But I assure you that the Dayton talks will continue. Dick Holbrooke has enough problems on his hands without having to worry about the consequences of a shutdown.
If the peace talks succeed, but then the peace still breaks down, would the Clinton administration then support the end of the arms of embargo to the Bosnians?
Well, just to clarify and underscore, of course, the Clinton administration has all along supported lifting the arms embargo against Bosnia. We have felt for what we believe are very compelling reasons that that should be done only multilaterally, that it should not be something that the United States does in defiance of the United Nations and our principal allies who have troops on the ground in Bosnia. But the short answer, I think, to the question is yes. But we have high hopes that the combination of the basic soundness of the agreement and the effectiveness of the force that will be deployed to implement that agreement will make this a hypothetical question that will not arise.
Isn't Bosnia really being set up for Croatia to eventually grab a chunk of Serbia? And won't that lead to another war?
Croatia to grab a chunk of Serbia. I've got to go back and look at the map on that. Let me just answer what I think may be the question in somewhat fuller context. And I addressed this in my remarks, but I want to repeat it here. All of the states that have emerged from the breakup of Yugoslavia must accept some basic principles if they want to be welcomed into the community of nations. And one of those principles is that what had been inter-republic frontiers or boundaries have now become international boundaries and must be respected as such. They must not be changed by force, by violence, or by intimidation. They can only be changed according to the rules specified, among other things, in the United Nations Charter and the CSCE, now OSCE, documents, and that is to say changed peacefully by negotiation. Therefore, it is unacceptable for any of the states in the area to think in expansionist terms or irredentist terms, and that certainly goes for Croatia. We all know why the question arises. It arises, among other things, because there have been, at least informally and unofficially, maps suggested that show Croatia and Serbia, in some sense, dividing up Bosnia. That is emphatically not the outcome that we will support or that the international community will tolerate. And I think it's very important to keep in mind, with all the troubles that we have in that part of the world, what has been accomplished in Geneva, in New York, and now in Dayton, the three parties, and that includes the president of Serbia as well as the president of Croatia, have accepted the fundamental proposition that Bosnia-Herzegovina will continue to exist within its own internationally recognized borders and with a separate international personality. And that is absolutely fundamental, not only to the success of these talks, but to peace in the region. And it is fundamental to the judgments that the international community is going to make about how to deal with these leaders in the future. They have their needs. They have their aspirations, but they also have their obligations.
Is Bosnia a transitional post-Soviet problem or typical of the ethnic strife we will continue to face even more frequently in the future? If the latter, how will we decide which conflicts require our intervention diplomatically?
Let me take the question in sort of the reverse order. I think that we have to be very careful. I'm sure we will be very careful as a nation to judge these challenges to regional and international peace and to our interests on a case-by-case basis. We have a combination of instrumentalities available to us, and those include the use of military force. They include the use of military force as in a peacekeeping capacity or, for that matter, in a war-fighting capacity in extremis. But we have other instrumentalities as well, including our national treasure, our humanitarian abilities, which are, of course, greatly reinforced by the private voluntary organizations and non-governmental organizations which thrive in this country, and we have our diplomacy. And as we address each one of these crises, we will have to make judgments about what combination to use and whether the stakes for the United States justify putting American forces in harm's way. And we have made that judgment with respect to Bosnia, but that doesn't mean there is a one-size-fits-all answer to any question we might face in the future. Now, if I could just say make one other point. There are a lot of problems in the former Soviet Union. And as I look out across this audience, I see a couple of colleagues who know those at least as well as I do, and not better, including some very dear friends. And I don't want to in any way minimize the difficulties that we are going to have in dealing with all 12 of the countries that have emerged from the old Soviet Union. The biggest of them sometimes seems like the biggest problem, but the biggest is also in many ways making some progress in significant areas. But a crucial and positive thing has occurred with regard to the former Soviet Union, and that is it broke up in a way that has respected the principle that former inter-republic frontiers would become international frontiers. We have not seen in the former Yugoslavia what might be called greaterism. And if only the wisdom of quite a few of the leaders in the former Yugoslavia, notably including Boris Yeltsin, had been transferred to Yugoslavia while it was breaking up, we might have an entirely different, we might not be talking about the former Yugoslavia today. But to put the same point in a more somber fashion, if the kind of greaterism, which has caused such terrible horror and problems in the former Yugoslavia, had occurred or were to occur in the future in the former Soviet Union, imagine what a problem we would have. And that is, as I alluded to in my remarks, yet another reason why we have a vital national interest in the former Yugoslavia. We must establish that what has happened there in the last 4 years is an aberration, and the international community is not going to permit it to happen elsewhere. And the fact that Ukrainians and Russians are working alongside of our people, including of our military people, in order to stuff back in the bottle the evil genie that has gotten out in the former Yugoslavia is very, very hopeful. And having interacted a lot in my own work with the leaders of quite a number of the former Soviet states, I can tell you that they see this danger that I'm talking about here much more clearly than we do, but we see it plenty clearly.
Speaking of Boris Yeltsin, do you expect him to recover, both medically and politically?
Yes. Obviously, more in my line of work now than in your line of work, which I used to be in, I must respect the importance of not speculating on the health of foreign leaders. I can tell you, though, that as recently as this morning, I was on the telephone to our very able ambassador in Moscow, Tom Pickering, who has stayed in very close touch with a number of President Yeltsin's colleagues, including some who have visited him in the hospital in recent days. President Yeltsin is feeling better. He says that he feels he is on the mend. We welcome that. We wish him a speedy recovery. Meanwhile, we are having, I think, a particularly favorable, positive period of cooperation and interaction with the Russian government. I think the extraordinarily productive series of talks that have taken place between Defense Minister Grachev and Secretary Perry is an example of that. Secretary Christopher and Andrei Kozarev are in close touch on a variety of issues. They saw each other in Amman recently. President Clinton had a brief but very substantive exchange with Prime Minister Chernomyrdin at the Rabin funeral. So. While President Yeltsin is recovering, we are fully engaged with the Russian government on a lot of important issues.
Can you explain the rather odd arrangement under which the Russian troops will serve in the Balkans? They will be subordinate to the American commander, but not the NATO commander. How does that work?
Well, as Defense Minister Grachev said when he was briefing the press yesterday, if I had a chart, I could do this for you. You know, military guys always like to have flip charts and view graphs and that kind of thing. Let me cut through the complexity of it and go to what is fairly simple here. We all know, and I think we understand the reasons for it, that it is difficult and indeed quite neuralgic for Russia to put itself directly under NATO command. However, what Dr. Perry and Minister Grachev have been able to work out is an arrangement that spares the Russians that onus, but at the same time preserves the unity of command of the implementation force and what we call, or what my colleagues in the Pentagon call, the unity of effort. What this means is that overall national command will remain with the Russian commander-in-chief, which is to say the President of the Russian Federation. Operational control, however, will be under General Jolwan, who in effect will be two-hatted, in that he is not only the supreme Allied commander in Europe, but he's also an American general. Moreover, the Russian unit participating in this force will be under the tactical control of an American divisional commander. Now, this is an arrangement that was worked out in the first instance by uniformed military officers, including on our side. General Shalakashvili has been intensively involved in these discussions with Minister Grachev when he was in visiting Washington recently, and General Jolwan has been directly involved in the process as well, and we've, of course, stayed in close touch with our allies. The issue of there are some other issues that still have to be worked out, but I think it is suffice it to say that the military arrangement for Russian U.S. Cooperation in Bosnia are now in place. As you know, there is another piece of this cooperative effort, which will involve what we're calling a special operations force made up jointly of U.S. and Russian forces that will be involved in non-combat but absolutely essential operations such as mine clearing, bridge repair, road building, and heavy lift transport. That will be, as it were, a kind of a sidebar to the implementation force, carrying out absolutely crucial work. It'll have a liaison relationship with the NATO command structure, but will not be directly under it. I think it is an excellent arrangement, and as I said, it not only has concrete benefit for the cause of implementing effectively peace in Bosnia, but I think it is a useful precedent that will help us get through the period ahead when we are going to continue to discuss with Russia its cooperative work with NATO as a whole.
Shifting for just a moment to Israel, the FBI has offered assistance in investigating Prime Minister Rabin's assassination. While this offer is standard procedure, the questioner wants to know whether you are aware of any ties between the alleged assassin and the United States.
No, I am not. Obviously, it's a very serious question, and it should be addressed to colleagues in the government who are working directly on that very important subject.
Thank you, sir. Now, before we get to our final question, a couple of gifts. First, a certificate of appreciation for being with us today, and also a National Press Club mug to help keep you awake during these times of difficult negotiation in Dayton. Last question, sir. Do you plan to serve in a second Clinton administration, if there is one?
I quarrel with the conditional phrase at the end of the question, and I accept the premise of the question, the first part of the question. It depends in large measure on, of course, whether I feel as vigorous and challenged and am having as much fun when that issue arises, as I'm sure it will. But right now I'm having the time of my life. I've missed the profession that you all are in and that I'm sure I will return to someday, but I'm having an awfully good time. But I'm glad to have another coffee mug because there are plenty of times where I do need a little bit of artificial stimulant, I can assure you of that. Anyway, it's been great fun to be with you today, and thank you so much for your hospitality.
And I thank you all for being with us this afternoon, and good afternoon.
Good talking to you.
All right.
Thank you.